It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a judge ruled in favor of a climate change lawsuit filed by young Montana residents. We'll find out what that could mean elsewhere in the country. First, when it comes to our digestive health, it can be hard to know how to take care of our gut. We might know which foods give us stomach problems, but what about promoting healthy digestion? There's a long list of products out there that contain prebiotics, probiotics, and postbiotics that claim to be good for our health, but not many of us know what those biotics actually are and whether we actually need them. And it's becoming more and more clear that our gut health is tied to our overall physical and even mental well-being. Our next guest has been covering the latest news about our gut microbiomes. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you take care of your gut health? Have you tried various blank biotic products? Do you eat with your digestive system in mind? What questions do you have about some of the latest science out there on the gut microbiome? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Anahad O'Connor is a health columnist who writes about food and nutrition for the Washington Post. He's written a series of columns over the last year looking at how prebiotics, probiotics, supplements, and foods affect our well-being. Anahad, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's explore a key concept here, our gut microbiome. It's an ecosystem in our digestive system. Can you tell us a little bit about what we're finding out about it?
Yeah, so the gut microbiome is essentially a community of microbes in our large, primarily in our large intestines, in our colon. It's at the end of our digestive tract, and we have trillions of these microbes. They are bacteria, fungi, all sorts of other little microbes that play a really important role in our health. They help us metabolize our food. They help regulate our immune systems. They produce all sorts of compounds, hormones and enzymes and compounds that are absorbed into our bodies and that affect our levels of inflammation and affect our appetites and seem to even play a role in our risk of getting chronic diseases like heart disease, diabetes, and potentially even cancer. And so there's been more and more research over the years looking at this vast community of microbes that we all have. And our gut microbiomes are almost like fingerprints. No two gut microbiomes are exactly alike. Even when you look at identical twins, they find that about a third of the gut microbiome is inherited. But a lot of our gut microbiome is shaped by lifestyle factors, in particular our diet, but also lifestyle behaviors like stress, how much alcohol we consume, exercise, and a lot of other lifestyles. But this gut microbiome plays a really important role in our health. We're still learning more and more about it every single day, but we know that it's critical to good health.
Reading your coverage on this, Anahad, I kind of had this change of mindset where I think I'm eating food, you know, I'm feeding Rob. In fact, I'm feeding the bacteria and other things that live in Rob's digestive system in a lot of ways, and different members of that community like different kinds of foods. What do we know?
Yeah, absolutely. So every time you take a bite of food, you're not just feeding Rob, you're feeding these trillions of microbes that are at the end of your digestive tract. There are actually even certain components of food like fiber that we eat every day, but we don't actually, human beings don't actually have the enzymes to metabolize fiber. It's our gut microbes that see this fiber and that metabolize it and that turn it into things like short chain fatty acids, which are compounds that are absorbed into our body and that are really good for all sorts of, you know, aspects of our health, from our brain health to our gut health to our levels of inflammation. So, you know, there's been research suggesting that when you're eating a lot of what you might call junk foods, that can have a negative effect on your health and that it might actually be mediated by the gut microbiome. And when you're eating a lot of beneficial foods like fiber, we're learning that one of the reasons these foods that we know are healthy, like fruits and vegetables, you know, fiber-rich plants, one of the reasons they're healthy is because these are the foods that our gut microbes typically love. And when we feed them these fiber-rich foods, our gut microbes are happy and they produce compounds that promote good health.
our gut microbiome in some ways is really complicated. But Anahat, again, reading your work, it seems like the basic recipe to help the good guys out there is really simple. A variety of plant-based foods. Is that really the starting point we should be thinking about?
Yes. So, you know, a lot of people, when they think about their gut microbiome and promoting gut health, one of the things that comes to mind is taking pills like probiotics, probiotic supplements. And, you know, this sort of makes sense when you think about it on the surface, at least. Probiotic supplements contain probiotics, which, just for our listeners out there, a probiotic is a live microbe that has beneficial effects on our health. So people think, oh, well, let me just take the pill and that'll help to seed my gut with beneficial bacteria. But what scientists are actually finding is that the best way, it seems, to promote an optimal or beneficial gut microbiome is by focusing on these fiber-rich foods, because by doing that, you know, if you think of your gut microbiome as sort of an ecosystem or even an intestinal garden, you know, you want to give your garden a lot of good fertilizer. It's not enough just to lay down the seeds. You want to actually give those foods, those seeds nutrition. And that's where fertilizer comes in. And the fertilizer for our gut microbiome is these fiber-rich foods. And there's also been studies showing that one of the best ways to promote a, you know, what we think is a healthy gut microbiome is by eating a particular type of foods. And those are fermented foods. Fermented foods like kimchi, sauerkraut, kefir, yogurt, even kombucha, even some fermented cheeses. These things have the probiotics, the live beneficial microbes, but they also have these other components as well. They have the prebiotics, which are the fiber, you know, the fertilizer for the gut microbes, the probiotics. And they also have postbiotics. So postbiotics, not to confuse you, but postbiotics are the compounds that the probiotics produce. You know, these microbes, when, you know, they live in our gut and they're metabolizing our food and they're creating a bunch of byproducts, and those byproducts they produce are called postbiotics. And those are the compounds like short chain fatty acids that we absorb into our body and, you know, help us to have a, you know, thriving, help us to be in good health, essentially.
Talking to Anahat O'Connor, health columnist at the Washington Post. He's been covering gut health for quite a long time now, looking at what foods promote gut health, the impact of a healthy ecosystem in our digestive system, and some of the products on the market, for better or worse. And you could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's check out one of those varieties of products, Anahat. Prebiotic sodas. You asked some healthcare experts. These are big in certain corners of social media, influencers selling these pretty heavy, the idea that these precursor products are going to be good for us. What did you find out when you talked to experts about things like prebiotic sodas available on the market?
Prebiotic sodas have become quite popular. They tend to have a type of prebiotic known as inulin. And that is a type of fiber that's been shown to promote beneficial bacteria. But these prebiotic sodas can have quite high levels of inulin. And it turns out that in this case, you can have too much of a good thing. There are some studies suggesting that when people consume really high levels of inulin, particularly when it's isolated, when it's extracted and isolated and then mixed into these sodas, if you're consuming, you know, two or three of these a day, that can cause gastrointestinal distress, and some studies show that that can even cause inflammation in some people. Essentially, it's, you know, you're consuming it at a level that your body's not used to, and it can be too much for your body to handle at once. But the thing is, there are actually a lot of foods with these special prebiotics in them. You can get prebiotics just by eating a lot of plants. So prebiotic foods include things like asparagus, onions, garlic, leeks, cabbage, peas, tomatoes, chicory, chickpeas, whole grains like oats, barley, rye, wheat, and corn, even fruits, apples, berries, bananas, and then nuts like almonds, pistachios, cashews, and seeds. These natural plant foods all contain prebiotics. That's one of the fibers they have. So they have a variety of fibers, including these special prebiotic fibers that are really good at promoting the beneficial bacteria.
Talking about the gut microbiome with Anahad O'Connor from the Washington Post. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried some of the products on the market, probiotics, you name it? Did they seem to have an impact for you? What questions do you have about our guest coverage of this part, an important part of our health? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Anahad O'Connor, health columnist for The Washington Post. He's with us today to share his reporting on the evolving research into our gut microbiomes, our digestive health, and how that all fits into wider physical and mental health issues. You could join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to a caller now. Chris is with us in Wauwatosa. Chris, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I have a question. Back when I was in school, I learned in my advanced microbiology course, the teacher was kind of against these dietary probiotic supplements and said that they don't really work just because of the density and so on and so forth. And, you know, by the time it gets to your gut, one thing that he did teach in the course was that your compositional diet, the sugars, the fats, the proteins, the carbohydrates and stuff like that does actually cause different microflora to, fill up your gut, I guess. And then that affects how much you get out of your food.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Anahad, first of all, you did talk to people about these probiotic supplements. What did you hear?
Yeah, so probiotic supplements, one reason they're very popular is because of antibiotics. You know, we use a lot of antibiotic medicines to help fight off infections. Antibiotics have been, really life-saving and critical. They've even helped to increase the average lifespan of the average American because they've been so crucial in medicine. But what we know is that antibiotics, they kill off the bad bacteria, the infections we want to get rid of, but they can also kill off the beneficial bacteria in our guts and in our bodies. And so there's this idea that if you take an antibiotic, you should pair it with a probiotic supplement to help repopulate your gut with beneficial bacteria. And we know from some studies that there are some benefits in this case to taking probiotics. Probiotics can help to reduce, for example, the diarrhea that is sometimes a side effect of taking antibiotic medications. But there have been studies that have looked into this and found that when people take probiotic supplements, it actually can shift your gut microbiome into sort of a different composition. And they found that when people don't take probiotic supplements after a course of antibiotics, that their gut microbiome typically reverts back to normal after a few weeks. But if they take this probiotic, it kind of shifts the composition of your gut microbiome in a direction and actually can make it less diverse. And we know in studies that when people have a very diverse gut microbiome, that tends to be associated with good health. And we think that's because, as I said, the gut microbiome is an ecosystem. It's sort of like a garden. You want to have a lot of different species of bacteria because these bacteria can all work together and they do different things. They keep one another in check. Some bacteria produce byproducts or postbiotics that are the food for other bacteria. Certain bacteria might, really like to metabolize a certain type of food, and then other bacteria want to metabolize other foods. And, it's just an ecosystem where you don't want one species sort of running amok. And they found that when people take probiotics, particularly after a course of antibiotics, that it can decrease their gut microbiome diversity. And that's sort of pushing things in the wrong direction. And so, there are gastroenterologists who study the gut microbiome who say that one thing they tend to do is recommend that people take what they call nature's probiotics. And those, again, are fermented foods. And, those are, the probiotics that we have been consuming for thousands of years. You look at cultures around the world, and almost every culture, has some sort of fermented food that's a part of their traditional diet. Sauerkraut in Eastern Europe and kimchi in Asia. There's hundreds of fermented foods that are part of traditional diets around the world. And so, the fermented foods, they contain these probiotics, but they also have the prebiotics, which are important, the fertilizer, and they have the postbiotics. So you're getting, you know, all these, this sort of rich soup or this rich food with this combination of good things for your gut. The other thing I think he mentioned, was promoting microflora and the effect that that, I think he mentioned on your weight, I think he said. There was actually a really fascinating study recently, that sort of demonstrated, when we think about weight loss, that all calories are not created equal. And one of the reasons for that is because of the gut microbiome. There was a study where they took people, they put them in metabolic chambers where they were able to measure their caloric expenditure, track their weight loss, track every calorie they consumed, and they gave them two different diets. On one diet, was a sort of standard American processed food diet with things like, American cheese and ground beef and potato chips and cookies and candy and sugary drinks and fruit juices, things that don't have very much fiber. And again, fiber is the thing that our gut microbes love. And the standard American diet tends to be very fiber deficient. And these are foods that are absorbed very rapidly in our intestines. We absorb them very quickly in our small intestines, and there's very little fiber that travels through the small intestine and gets to the large intestine at the end of our digestive tract where the gut microbiome is. And so when you're eating this ultra-processed, fiber-deficient diet, you're almost starving your gut microbes. And in this study, they had another diet that was a fiber-rich diet with, you know, foods like oats and barley and lots of plants and fruits and vegetables. And on that diet, they found that the people's gut microbiomes were thriving, and they found were absorbing fewer calories. So both of these diets had the same amount of calories, let's say 2,000 calories per diet. But on one diet, the ultra-processed food diet, people were absorbing significantly more of the calories into their bodies, while on the other diet, the fiber-rich diet, it was almost like they were feeding a lot of their calories to the gut microbes. And so people actually started to lose weight on the fiber-rich diet because it was – you know, essentially they were feeding a lot of their calories to the gut microbes. And the best part is that the gut microbes in turn were producing higher levels of beneficial compounds like short chain fatty acids. And they even helped these people produce higher levels of GLP-1, which is a satiety hormone. And we all have heard, you know, these wonder stories about these drugs, Wegovy and Ozempic. Well, these drugs are designed to mimic GLP-1. And it turns out that when you feed your gut microbes fiber, they produce short chain fatty acids, and that helps to increase your body's natural production of GLP-1. And so that's one reason why fiber is so good for you and why so many studies have shown that fiber actually helps with weight loss.
Talking to Anhad O'Connor from the Washington Post about our gut health, our microbiomes, and wider issues related to them. Back to your calls now. Perry is with us in Oconto. Perry, hi.
Great topic, Rob. My question, I was going to ask about the foods with the good bacteria in it, but I have another question because you kind of answered that. I've heard that eating meat really can drop your good microbiome down, the good bacteria, and eating like a meal a day or something with meat can really drop that, and it takes a while to build it back up.
Perry, thanks for the call. Anhad, I know we've talked about the good stuff, like a variety of veggie and plant products, the bad stuff, very processed, you know, the donuts I love to eat. Where do we know where meat fits into the picture, meats fit into the picture when it comes to our microbiome?
Yeah, that's a good question. There hasn't been a ton of research on meat specifically. So most of what the research has shown is that typically people who are very healthy tend to have a diverse gut microbiome, as I said, with lots of different species. And, you know, a diverse gut microbiome tends to be associated with better health, you know, with lower rates of chronic diseases, better or less obesity, things like that. And one way to achieve a diverse gut microbiome is just to eat a wide variety of whole foods. So in this actual study that I talked about, you know, where they showed that this healthy, fiber-rich diet, what they called a microbiome enhancer diet, because this diet was really feeding the gut microbes. They actually did include some meat in that microbiome enhancer diet, but the key was really what they were adding. It was all the fiber, you know, all these just a wide variety of fiber-rich foods, oats, vegetables, fruits, nuts and seeds, And so they found, you know, what we're seeing from studies is that I haven't really seen any studies that show that meat in particular is going to, you know, have a pretty detrimental effect on your gut microbiome. But if you're eating, you know, sort of a whole foods diet that includes some meat, seafood, you know, poultry, but you have a lot of fiber-rich foods, then that tends to be associated with, you know, promoting a diverse gut microbiome. And there have been studies looking at sort of modern hunter-gatherer populations around the world where they eat, you know, these populations like the modern hunter-gatherers in Tanzania and in South America. They sort of eat the way our ancestors have eaten, you know, for thousands of years. And they typically have diets that have much higher levels of fiber than the standard American diet. We're talking like 10 times the, like 10 times the amount of fiber that we eat on a daily basis. But they also do include some meat in their diets. You know, they go hunting, you know, they try to, you know, have, you know, it varies day by day, but they try to have some meat in their diet to get the protein. But, you know, fiber is really the basis of their diets. And that's what we know is going to really promote what appears to be an optimal gut microbiome. That's the key: fiber, fermented foods.
Perry, thanks for that call. And Anahad, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Anahad O'Connor, health columnist for The Washington Post, who writes about food and nutrition. He was with us today to talk about some of the latest research and reporting on our gut microbiomes and how to improve our digestive health. I guess my gut doesn't know which side I'm on because I eat a lot of the good stuff we were talking about, but I love donuts and other pastries. So fight it out down there, I guess, guys. Coming up after the news, we take a look at a landmark case in Montana where plaintiffs succeeded in arguing that the state government was violating their right to a clean environment. A lot of lawsuits like these going on around the country. We'll find out about the impact of this one, if it could advance the cause of other cases, similar cases around the country. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the U.S. women's national soccer team was recently eliminated from the World Cup. The news received mixed reactions, including celebration from some American conservative commentators. We'll find out how women's soccer became politically contentious. Now, the plaintiffs in a landmark climate change case in Montana have won, potentially setting precedent in other states. The youth plaintiffs in Held versus Montana argued that the state deprived them of their right granted in their own state constitution to a clean and healthy environment. Plaintiffs, represented by the group Our Children's Trust, argued that the state deprived them of this right by promoting the use of fossil fuels and by explicitly outlawing the consideration of climate change when considering new energy projects. An appeal is expected. The case, the ruling, is unprecedented, and it could have an impact on future environmental law elsewhere in the country. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of climate change lawsuits on behalf of young people? Do you think people should have constitutional rights to a clean and healthy environment, as states like Montana and a few others do? Would you want to see that in Wisconsin's state constitution? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Steph Tye is a professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School and associate dean for the UW-Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. Steph, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here, as usual.
Before we dig into the particulars of this Montana case, it seems like I've been seeing this kind of lawsuit on behalf of younger people about climate change popping up here and there around the country. Are you seeing this as a growing tactic?
Yes. Our Children's Trust, the nonprofit that has been leading all of these cases, has been pretty active in a bunch of different states, both building on states that have constitutional requirements for consideration of the environment, but also leading different types of actions, not just against states themselves, but also against various companies, et cetera.
How big a deal is this ruling in this Montana lawsuit? Is this something that you think might reverberate elsewhere in the country?
Yeah, so there's a few other states that have similar kinds of rights in their constitution. I think Hawaii is one of them. And it's likely that this will set some kind of soft precedent for similar lawsuits in those cases. Now, it's important to be aware of what's involved in this case, mm-hmm. because the case doesn't compel the government to do anything affirmative to address climate change. But what it does do is the state court judge has said that the law that was passed by Montana that restricted agencies from reviewing the climate change impacts of their various actions, they said that that was unconstitutional according to the state constitution. And so that takes off the table this sort of veil of ignorance that was created by those laws. And furthermore, the judge said that that actually compelled agencies, the state constitution compels agencies to have to consider those effects when making things like permitting decisions for new power plants, making decisions like opening new kind of wells, all of those kinds of decisions.
Right. So you're keying in on some of the unique things of Montana where we might not have a similar lawsuit in Wisconsin. One, Montana's state constitution guarantees a healthful environment, clean and healthful environment to their residents. Wisconsin and most states don't do that. And this particular law saying, hey, you can't consider climate change in the decisions. A lot of states, of course, don't have that. How much of this hinged on those two very particular issues in a state like Montana?
Both of those were incredibly important to the decision here. For example, in Wisconsin, we don't have any bar against agencies considering climate change. And so there's been a number of lawsuits against the Public Service Commission for failure to adequately consider the impact of climate change on new permitting decisions for power plants. And so that wasn't ever taken off the table in Wisconsin. And it's true that while Wisconsin doesn't have the right to a clean and healthy environment, we do have some softer aspects of our Constitution that perhaps groups might try to use even more emphatically after this case. We have, for example, in Wisconsin, the public trust doctrine, which is limited to waters, but climate change can potentially affect the availability of waters. And we also have a right to hunt and fish in Wisconsin. And to the extent that a lawsuit can be geared up to claim that failure to consider the right to fish, hunt and fish is to consider climate change impact on the right to hunt and fish, that might also be an avenue that litigants could take.
Talking to Steph Tye from the UW Law School, Associate Dean for the UW Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, looking at this lawsuit. You may have seen the headlines out of Montana, a lawsuit on behalf of younger people challenging a law in that state that said state agencies couldn't consider climate change in evaluating energy development there. You can join in with your reactions, your thoughts, maybe your questions at 800-642-1234. And what do you think about that wider issue of strategy, really, of issuing lawsuits on behalf of younger people on the basis that they may be greatly affected by climate change down the road? Join in at 800-642-1234. And this idea, Steph, groups like Our Children's Trust, filing lawsuits on behalf of younger people trying to demonstrate that they in particular would feel harm of climate-related policies. How does that affect issues of things like standing in cases like these?
Yeah, so what's interesting is that Montana also has a somewhat unique aspect of its constitutional doctrine that says that young people also have this kind of special standing, that those under 18 are still available to bring these kinds of lawsuits. And this kind of right is protected in the Montana state constitution because the idea is that, you know, without that availability of lawsuits, then, you know, generations in the future will be missing a lot of key protections. And so I think part of that, too, is part of the overall strategy in bringing this case. Other states don't necessarily have that right laid out as Montana. And so some of that will sort of result in differences in some of the outcomes in different states.
Big picture climate change policy. Do you expect to see a lot of difference made by lawsuits like these, or are solutions more likely to come from legislative or executive actions?
I think it comes from a lot of them, right? So one thing that this case does say is it puts a halt on some of the legislation that is sort of anti taking climate change action. That is, it will give future legislatures some pause in terms of passing laws saying you can't consider the impact of some kind of agency action on the environment. And so some of the sort of threat of sort of, I guess, climate change promoting legislation, basically, fossil fuel promoting legislation, some of that will be lessened. But I think that still further action still needs to be taken, not just in terms of the defense, which this is basically a defensive action, and more of an active kind of engagement. For example, California and New York have addressed these, have created these large climate change programs to ensure a shift in terms of their energy grid to more renewables. And I think Washington State is starting to do that. And so it takes not only defensive actions such as this, but also, I guess, offensive action, not offensive actions, but, you know, positive actions such as what's being done in some states.
We're talking about the victory of plaintiffs in a landmark climate case in Montana. Our guest is Steph Tighe, professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, associate dean for the UW-Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about this particular Montana youth climate case? Would you want to see similar action here in Wisconsin? How important do you think the courts are or should be when it comes to climate change? Wisconsin is not one of a handful of states with a so-called Green Amendment guaranteeing something like a clean and healthful environment as Montana does. Would you like it to be? Would you like to have that clause in the Constitution? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with UW-Madison Law Professor Steph Tighe about the victory of plaintiffs in a Montana youth climate change case, what it means for environmental litigation elsewhere in the country. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What role do you think young people should play in climate change activism? How about lawsuits on their behalf? What do you think of the idea of a state constitutional guarantee of a clean environment, a healthful environment, as Montana and a few other states have? Wisconsin does not have that clause. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Steph, we've got a handful of states, as I mentioned, with these environmental guarantees in their constitution. In addition to Montana, you've got Illinois, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and Hawaii. Interesting mixed bag. Is there a movement to do this in more states, or was that something that just happened and then stopped happening across the country?
No, that's a great question. One of the difficulties is that many states are pretty locked in terms of being able to pass constitutional amendments. I don't remember the survey of how constitutional amendments are initiated, but it varies a lot from state to state. Some of them have to start off with petitions. Some of them have multiple methods. And so I think we've been seeing fewer constitutional amendments recently, but that might change. Again, part of that's going to depend on the electoral system in different states. And with various observations of gerrymandering going on in various states, I think that that will make it more difficult in some states to initiate these kind of constitutional changes.
Let's bring in a caller. Doug is with us in Colfax. Doug, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think it would be helpful to add that to the Wisconsin state constitution, given the climate change ramifications seem to be only getting worse. I would just like to add that I think, given that wind and solar are now cheaper forms of generating electricity than any other, that it would make sense for our state to just push for renewables, period, just because it makes financial sense.
Doug, thanks a lot for the call. And, Steph, do you see the debate changing that way from we're talking about the environment and climate change to we're talking about economic impacts of alternative energy?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think part of the way in which climate change has gotten politicized ignores some of the real economic realities. I mean, even without a strong climate change policy in Wisconsin, we have shifted from in the 90s being around in the 80% reliance upon coal-generated electricity to now probably around, like, I think 50%. Natural gas is much less expensive. Solar and wind are also less expensive. And so there's already some kind of economic reason to shift energy sources. And in some ways, the people fighting against it are fighting against what's actually technologically and economically more practical for everyone.
Thanks for that call. Nadia joins us now in Milwaukee. Nadia, hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm a recent college graduate, and I think as a young person, it's vitally important for Wisconsin to adapt this clause, and I'm hoping that the case in Montana sets some precedent so that we can adapt changes as soon as possible. I also don't think it's just the responsibility of our young people in Wisconsin. I think that parents and grandparents should be worrying about what our future is, and everybody should care less about perhaps how much it will cost now and how much we can gain from this economically in the future.
Nadia, thanks a lot for that call. Steph, do you see a growth in advocacy, whether it's actually in the courts or not, either by young people or, as Nadia says, on their behalf by parents and grandparents when it comes to environmental issues?
I absolutely agree with Nadia that it shouldn't just be borne by the younger people. But I do see a huge growth in students interested in learning about and addressing climate change. When I first started teaching at UW Law School in 2006, there were students who were interested in environmental law, but they weren't focused specifically on climate change. Whereas now, like, I'm getting almost every student cares about it, and even students who are going into different areas of law. They're planning to go into being like a public defender or a prosecutor. They're planning on being like a housing lawyer. They're still caring about climate change. And so I think there is this real shift because we're seeing a lot of the actual changes appear before our eyes. And so, yes, I think it's changing. I'm sad that it's taken so long, and I'm sad that our generations have let you down.
Nadia, thanks a lot for that call. Steph, we've been focusing on one particular piece of litigation, and a particular kind of lawsuit. Are there other environmental law issues you are focused on right now, especially related to climate change?
Yeah, so there's two aspects. So there's the litigation element of things where there is litigation against not just this law which prohibited the consideration of the impact of climate change, but also litigation on the sort of individual permit level, right? That's, I mentioned that in Wisconsin, that the Public Service Commission has to go through and approve of different permits. And so that's happening on the ground everywhere in different states. Allegations that state agencies are failing to fully consider the cost of climate change. And there's a lot of those cases are fairly successful. There's also cases involving the listing of endangered species because climate change creates a huge threat to them. So it happens in a lot of different areas. There's also sort of these private nuisance suits against individual companies for their contributions to climate change. And so I would say that, yes, those are a lot of different kind of active areas of litigation. At the same time, there's also legislation, like, for instance, the Inflation Reduction Act, that is trying to push more money towards mitigation-related measures and adaptation-related measures. And so we have to think about all of those in the legal mix as well. And then finally, there's, I want to sort of bring up also how there are private companies that are actually trying to affirmatively respond to concerns about climate change and sort of making these sorts of commitments to reduce their own carbon footprints. And many of those are working with what we often don't think of as legal structures because it's not like lawsuits, but what they're doing is they're crafting different types of contracts to ensure that their entire supply chain is abiding by certain types of standards to lower their carbon footprint. And so there's all of that out there that's happening right now.
Steph, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Steph Tai is a professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School and associate dean for the UW Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. We've been talking about a landmark climate change case called Held versus Montana. A group representing young plaintiffs there challenged a state law under their state constitution. Been talking about youth lawsuits there and elsewhere in the country. If you have thoughts on that, if you've participated in something like this or someone you know has, love to hear your story. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Formerly incarcerated people who struggle with opioid addictions are at a high risk of overdosing when they're released from prison. In Milwaukee County, a substance abuse treatment program combines medication and drug counseling to try to reduce those risks. Evan Casey has more on how that program helped one man change his life.
5 years ago, David Stockton was strung out on heroin, homeless, and sleeping in a tent in downtown Milwaukee. Now, he's almost 1 year sober.
I'm at the point in my life where I'm doing this for me. And that's really the only way it works.
In 2011, Stockton injured his back while working. He was prescribed opioids for the pain. But soon, he was hooked. The 45-year-old Richfield native says he spent time in prison last year after he was convicted of writing bad checks to help pay for his addiction. But today, Stockton says he's sober because of a medication-assisted treatment program he started while he was still behind bars. That program is called Behind the Walls.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know where I'd be today if it wasn't for this opportunity.
The program is a public-private partnership that operates inside the Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center. Stockton received drug treatment counseling as well as prescription medications that help him stay clean. One helps relieve withdrawal symptoms. Another drug that's sometimes prescribed is called naltrexone. It blocks the sedative effects of opioids. That means even if someone were to use, they wouldn't get high. Jennifer Whitwer is the director of Milwaukee County's Community Access to Recovery Services Department. She says before the program started in 2019, the prison didn't offer treatment for inmates.
The best that we could do before this program was that we would get people connected to medication-assisted treatment services the day of their release. But often, that was too late.
A 2018 study found that after release, former inmates were 40 times more likely to die of an overdose compared to someone in the general population. That's just one reason Whitwer says the program is essential.
They're in a correctional facility they can't use, and it gives people an opportunity to really reevaluate where they're at in their life and what they want their life to look like post-incarceration.
Inmates have to have a documented substance abuse disorder and volunteer for the program. When they're released, they continue their treatment at a local clinic. That's where people like Amy Malinsky with Community Medical Services come in.
Being able to get somebody started in treatment while they're already in custody and having a plan for them, an intake appointment scheduled, like everything ready to go for their day of release, we're relieving so much of that burden off of the individual.
Milwaukee's program got a large chunk of cash this year from a historic settlement with opioid manufacturers that'll help pay for it for several more years. Earlier this summer, Stockton showed visitors around the Fourth Dimension Sobriety Home.
So, yeah, as you can see, this used to be a school. So we got the little jungle gym. But yeah, we've got a little bonfire area.
He's been living at the home for just over 8 months now. He came here as a resident, but now he's a manager, and he takes pride in helping others. He recently helps organize a cookout with other sober living homes in the area.
Being in recovery, it's a community, and we like to bring people together.
For Stockton, expanding treatment options for inmates is a matter of life and death.
With the proper guidance, the proper motivation, the proper medication, that brought me to a place where I found my self-worth. And that goes a long way.
On Saturday, Stockton will celebrate his 46th birthday. The next day, he'll celebrate 1 year of sobriety. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Follow Evan and our great news team over at WPR.org/news. You can read stories, listen to stories, and share them with others. Find it all at WPR.org. We can also live stream this network, our other network, and search through our archives of talk programs as well. Find it all over at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, it is back to school season. Get some advice on health and medical needs for children as the new school year starts. Join in with your questions, maybe your experiences as a student or parent or working at a school yourself. Join in with questions about vaccines as well and what you need to know as you get ready for that new school year. You can email now, ideas@WPR.org, then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 8:30. That's here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday at this time, I asked for your suggestions about what to do with lots of zucchini, an annual dilemma. I have some plans in mind, and you emailed a couple of suggestions. Saul sent a recipe for Turkish zucchini pancakes with yogurt. Looks like it's from a cookbook, so I can't post it, but it sounds good. The basic concept, a savory pancake made with shredded zucchini, of course, eggs, and stuff including dill and feta, then topped with a yogurt sauce with garlic, tomato, lime, and cilantro. Sounds really good. A listener named Dana writes about another customer for zucchini, the dog. Dana says zucchini is a big hit, whether it's fresh, steamed, or dehydrated into a zucchini jerky. I checked on veterinary website zucchini, fine for dogs, in moderation. One note, don't give them the stuff you're eating if you put seasonings on it. Some seasonings, bad for dogs. Just the zucchini there. Me, I mentioned all that zucchini I have. Now I have a loaf of zucchini bread that my mother-in-law made for us. So I didn't use up any zucchini, but it is delicious. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to The Ideas Network from Wisconsin Public Radio.